Well, g'day everyone, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is an Australian social media influencer who posts under the name Ozpill. Today we discuss how he became interested in immigration and how the new edgy style of discussing this issue on social media works better than more traditional means, the restrictions on freedom of speech in Australia and elsewhere, and how concern over adolescent and red-pilled young men is misguided, why it is so hard for Australian politicians to discuss mass immigration forthrightly, and where youth politics is heading in Australia and elsewhere in the West, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Ozpill, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you for having me, Dan. It's good to be here. I think I'm preceded by a guest of people with a lot of prestige, so should I live up to that?
Well, we've been quite keen to talk to you as well. And I know I'm tearing you away from your spring break parties in Florida, so I appreciate the sacrifice that one makes. You've established a bit of reputation of yourself online as a critic of immigration generally. How did you actually get interested initially in that subject?
Well, it is a very interesting story. And it relates to the account itself and where that started. It's an interesting story. So it started 2024 as like a fitness account, like gym stuff. But like specifically, I was quite interested in like studies around fitness and particularly that of like biohacking, which I was very skeptical of. And what that means is like people who do like little tricks to try and increase things like testosterone. And the account was sort of skeptical of all those things, and I was making videos that were taking the whatever trend is and like being a skeptic and like dismissing it through studies. And this one biohacking trend came up to do with testosterone, and I was just doing my like literature review to try and like, you know, bring it down to reality. And in the course of that was looking at fertility as an analog of testosterone markers in a population. And at that time in my life, I knew for certain, like Japan was a country which had a low birth rate and had a shrinking population. And so to me, that was, I think everyone sort of knows that. Like you hear the headlines, it's a fairly big deal. Like it's a population that's shrinking and it's crazy. And so as I was going through the statistics around that, I actually saw Australia wasn't too far behind. Not only in like the fertility rate itself, but actually the decline in it. And that kind of blew me away because I'd like gone through my whole life and all this research and stuff and never heard of that before. And I was like, so is Australia's population shrinking? Actually, no, it's growing at an incredible rate. At that point, I think it just hit or was about to hit 27 million. And I was like, well, why is that? And of course, it was immigration. And so I scrapped the original video idea and just presented one on immigration and the birth rate. And it's actually a bit of a hit. People are really like, was not only surprised, but like engaging with that video more than any others I've done before that. And I guess from there, it like unlocked that Pandora's box. And it quickly became very political, as you imagine it does.
Yeah, it does attract a lot of heat and interest online. I've found it interesting that, look, there have always been people that have been against immigration, but in recent times online, there's been some good attempts at making the issue not so much of one that focuses on angry chants, but almost making immigration restrictionism hip or trendy. I mean, is there a lot of thought that's gone into that? I mean, What influenced you in determining the style in which to make the argument?
Well, that's interesting. Like, you're right. It was always like the most carnal reaction to it. The most primitive reaction is like a tribal one where it's, you're right, these chants and whatever else. But there has been almost like institutional like resistance growing in the form of economic arguments, cultural arguments, which are more centered around, I guess, things that are less things you can like write in a paper, right? Like that's the sort of the direction things are going now, where it's more you could have university lecturers present an argument that you couldn't just dismiss as racist. But for me, it was like, I don't know. I think it was like a natural abridging of like the meme and internet culture I was just exposed to in my age bracket. And that is just how I sort of naturally tended to express these ideas. If that makes sense, like it wasn't, I guess it wasn't too intentional. This is just how it like naturally expresses itself.
It wasn't sort of a particular intentional, I don't know, marketing strategy. It was just the cultural sort of milieu that you grew up in and
I suppose it's also like these are things like, I guess the trends I contort into like politics, they are themselves already popular. So I guess like, because making videos online, it's like a market and you sort of like tap into where the demand is. And if a particular trend is blowing up, you can just make a video in that format. And I just happen to be like the only person who's doing that in like, let's say like a way that's critical of immigration. And it's that it blows up in part because it's the trend, but also the novelty of the fact that someone just made it political is the best way I can think of it. But I haven't had that intention like where I've sat down and wrote this all out. In fact, that's my problem lately is I'm not scripting enough. I'm just sort of like letting the camera rip and then the words come to me. Like I'm speaking as like a medium. I need to probably, that's something I need to work on. But yeah, I haven't thought of this in such a great way.
Yeah. But you're not just about making goofy memes. I mean, I can tell listening to you that you've now done a deep dive into this subject matter, right? What do you read, which is more kind of long form or more kind of dense on the subject of mass immigration? What have been your more traditional kind of sources of influence?
Well, look, I read a lot of texts. Like the book I'm reading at the moment by B.C. Smith, it's called The Origin of Objects, which itself is like an ontological read, not really like related to immigration, but one more of like identity and being. So I read like texts which are like quite abstract, but in terms of like maybe the more down to earth, like Australian immigration texts, like is that sort of what you're referring to? I'd say Macro Business is a really good resource. Leith is like a fantastic economist. There's various texts like within the sub-Australian like political culture, like Observer and Review. I'm not sure if you've heard of that. By the Stream Press, Sidestream Press, that's really fantastic. And there are like intellectuals who orbit around and there you can find them on X. They're like the Anons, like the anonymous accounts. And a lot of them are like guys who are pretty tapped in, but they just have careers. So they can't be public facing. But when you talk to them, they're very insightful. But as for like texts that I read on immigration, I don't know. Like I try and read a bit of everything. There's nothing particularly that's like foundational, I would say. Unfortunately, I wish there was, like, because people ask me, oh, what can I read? And it's like, I don't know, like you just gotta tap into
The Anons are often the smartest people online. Well, usually the smartest people online, I find. It is interesting though that that highly credentialed people still have to hide behind anonymous accounts. What do you make of, look, there's been hysteria in the UK about red pill men and the impact on young boys and the internet, and that was that film that came out, Adolescence, which is now seems to be almost mandatory viewing for everyone in the whole country over there. And there's a similar type of concern in Australia about that. What do you make of that, and what would be your answer to try to assuage the fears of people who don't actually follow these accounts and don't understand them and are worried about them?
I think like young, fundamentally, like for young men who are in like a really formative stage in their life and who have like some of the rawest expression of like, let's say for example, like their hormones are like going crazy. They're like they're like becoming masculine and as a result like their minds go crazy. And like I actually think that accounts people are like worried that they will find some accounts and like spin out, but I think a lot of the time and the advice that some accounts give, and maybe the way that I even present this information, is steering them away. Because the idea is like, oh, they'll stumble across this and become violent. But it's like, in its most primordial form, like, what do we have? We have like, men are like very competitive. And if you have another man being introduced to your like realm, you become like, you don't like that as a man. And so young men are living through a period where millions of foreign men are moving into their like land. And in its most like primordial reaction is like, not happy with that. But by teaching people and letting them know that there is like a political outlet, or at least one that's forming, you guide them in a way that, instead of like violently having an outburst against this, the hope is that maybe they might get that degree or the high paying career, and maybe they might become an anon, or they might become in the political circuit, because you can help them channel that energy into politics instead of just that racist chanting or whatever. That I think that, I guess I haven't seen adolescents, but what I can tell is that it's just trying to say that young men like are being amplified into violence by these accounts. But I don't know which accounts it's referring to, but I think one like mine and many like it aren't making them any more racist or whatever they're trying to say. But the channeling the energy behind that into forms which are more productive. Because men will always have this reaction, because it is primordial. But helping them in a modern form, like magnified into something that is political and more constructive, is probably better for society. Like, if you ban these ideas, this is where it becomes worse. If you try and legislate them away, like psychologists will always say this, if you try and ban ideas and people and politics, then you get actual violent reactions. I think even Mark Burgess from ASIO in Australia said this. Like, to some extent, you have to let these things fester or ferment or whatever, because then at least there is an outlet. And more often than not, that is a more constructive outlet, because they at least have like a light at the end of the tunnel. And so my reaction to the adolescent stuff is just crazy, because to make that mandatory viewing, and I don't know what else is going to come with that, the legislation, banning all these accounts and relegating them probably to worse parts of the internet, like, it's just, it'd probably be a mistake, is for as I can say. If that clicks with you, I don't know if that was a too long.
It's also I find it so disingenuous too, because the real threat to young girls and women in the UK is not 13-year-old white boys, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's be real. I mean, they've got track record now of the most atrocious crimes being committed, and they weren't being committed by young teenagers.
That's probably the most ridiculous part. Like, people were saying, and I'm not sure if this is true, because I think even the director tried to deny this, but that it was based on the Axel Rukabana, was his name, stabbing, where he decapitated young white girls, dragged them back into that dance studio, stabbed one, I think, over 120 times.
Yeah.
People say that's what it was based off. The director denies it. But I think as to what you were saying, it's like that has got to be one of the most violent and like horrific things in a long time in the UK. And for them, maybe it was a bad timing for this show to release, but to then try and make it about, young white guys. Like,
they're clearly trying to deflect from their failure to tackle not only that issue, but also obviously the Pakistani, predominantly Pakistani rape sort of been occurring in the UK for the last 30 plus years. So it's crazy. That said, I mean, it's interesting what you mentioned, the ASIO director in Australia saying that you should allow this stuff to circle online, or at least as an outlet, because that is not the attitude of the political class in Australia, and particularly Victoria, right? And there have been incredibly new, strict free speech laws introduced. What do you make of that? And do you actually worry that you might bump up against those at some stage?
Well, I think Mike Burgess and ASIO and broadly our intelligence services seem to be quite level-headed when it comes to this stuff, in recognizing that this is like their job, and they have analysts who study like this behavior and extremism, and who come to inform the broader organization's decisions. And you can see them in these Senate hearings and Senate inquiries where you'll have a Greens MP saying, ban everything and lock them all up and like all this stuff. And the response always has to be where, as I said, you have to allow these ideas to some degree ventilate. And they would be looking at case studies where they didn't. And it just ends worse because people get demoralized and there is no political outlet. And all that's left is the rawest expression of what is, again, as I was saying earlier, a primordial, like carnal, savage, like response. And you don't want that. You want it to be channeled into like something at least where you can monitor it as well, which if it's just online stuff, that's easy. You don't want it to be banned and they have to be secretive and then it's a nightmare even and you get lone wolves and stuff. So the political class don't have that knowledge and don't have that expertise and have like a very short-term mindset. And they want that political victory of like, we banned the right wing or something. And so that's my understanding is simply that the political class don't see what the intelligence services see. And they're naive and thinking they can just ban these things. But I have faith in that the intelligence services are at least level-headed. And then when it comes to me bumping up against these laws, they are very, very broad and they can be quite vague. Like you can't cause like reasonable insult to someone based off virtually any characteristic of them. Migration status, there's a long list. And it's such a long list that I might be bumping up against them already. I don't know. It just depends now whether like the director of public prosecutions will accept that it's going to be good optics to go after people like me. I don't know. I feel like they maybe like these are laws that are really vague, but their application still as maybe the intelligence services, like the, I'm holding out that like there will be some people who will say this would just not be like a worthwhile case. But I think there's definitely a potential for someone. Even if you're critiquing migration broadly, you could be causing offense to migrant communities. And you know, if you say, oh, if it's not just a purely statistical observation or economic one, and you say instead they have a cultural impact that's dangerous for Australia, that could cause offense and that could get you prison time. Vaguely based on these laws, it could. That could be...
There's a risk. You haven't been... you haven't encountered that to date? No one's filed any complaint or you don't have to say if it's confidential, but I'm just curious because Victoria is fairly litigious. You know, you've had situations down there where, well, probably most famously, you know, you had a well-known columnist, Andrew Bolt, who was successfully fined for trying to pinpoint corruption in the Aboriginal industry with someone claiming to be, or at least saying that someone could be claiming to be Aboriginal fraudulently in order to obtain taxpayer funds. So to me, that's a legitimate public issue, but it wasn't successful in the end of it because of the laws down there. In that case, there were federal laws, but in Victoria's got even tougher. So I'm just kind of curious as to whether it will be possible going forward, like you said, to discuss not only immigration in a very abstract way, but any of the kind of real world and often not very pleasant consequences of it.
I mean, look, I can only imagine like they don't want to make a martyr out of anyone either because we saw people like Elon love when other countries are prosecuting people for, you know, violations and destroying like free speech. And he, you know, we have an interesting relationship with America where I am currently, you know, maybe I might have to seek political refuge here. Who knows? But in Victoria, if they were to use these laws, like the spectacle, as I was saying earlier, like the martyr, like the spectacle it would cause, I feel like even people who don't agree with me, at least the sensible ones, may say that's a bit too far. And as I was saying with the director of public prosecutions, the optics and their decision to prosecute might be on a collar where it's a leash where it's like that reaction would be too visceral. It can't be justified. But I hadn't actually heard about that Bolt case, but that sounds maybe it was more civil. Like
Yeah, it was a civil case. It was ultimately civil. Yeah, okay. That's the change. The criminal sort of penalties for particular types of speech now in Victoria.
The criminal bar would be set higher by the Director of Public Prosecutions, but in those laws, it does allow, it has opened up new civil pathways. In Victoria, the hate speech, like the big amendment was that it allowed private prosecution and civil prosecution on these insults. So that would be like, that's even more annoying because people can just, there's no DPP behind those cases. It's just like how much money you can give a law firm. So that would, that's like annoying because like it could, like you, these cases can start and then you have to like fight them, whatever. They can just fiddle out. But it's just like painful because it's just, that's more annoying because there is no level-headedness behind them. It's just whoever can give lawyers money and lawyers will just do it.
Well, as soon as they take on a case of someone who doesn't like you and they're off to the races. Yeah, I mean, I must say I'm not quite as optimistic as you are that the level-headedness of the DPP about taking action for different reasons because they have done so in the past, even with people who have, a large section of support in the community. What do you think? You're on a lot of the different social media platforms, Twitter and TikTok and the rest of it. What do you make about TikTok? I mean, how would you describe, because there's a lot of concern in sections of the community about TikTok and it being a Chinese app and that they would use it potentially at some stage to sort of create dissent amongst the Australian community. What's been your experience with it and what do you think of those fears?
They're interesting fears because like the recent debacle in the US where they temporarily banned it, was the public, I think even though Trump's admin was the original one to bring up the need for the ban, it's funny how they also then became the ones to undo it. Like what a stunt that was, but they obviously, these servers are based in Western countries and like TikTok Australia has, I think it's all registered here. I imagine they're based, they have servers in Australia or in Oceania broadly. They would have their team based in Australia, headquarters of the region in Australia. And even the company itself, like the CEO, there's that famous clip of him, Senator, I'm Singaporean. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
Yeah, but I have.
Like, it seems to be reasonably well vetted now that although it ByteDance, which I believe is the owner, is Chinese, the operation itself is like, it has regional operations such that like you cannot reasonably say that the whole thing is just straight up controlled by China. Although there were issues, for example, with investigators finding that ByteDance operatives in China were accessing American user data, but that stuff all seemed quite frivolous because it was, they were accessing like, look, the fears I think are unfounded. And I think what TikTok has done broadly is, they were the first social media introduced to the game that didn't penalize political content. Because prior to that, Meta did. If you uploaded political stuff to, for example, Instagram, it would get no reach. That was one of their policies, was like political content we don't really like. We're not going to push it. We don't want people to come across content that is on the wrong political aisle for them or the correct. And we don't want to embolden the wrong ideas and we don't want to spread the wrong ideas, but we also don't want people to have that visceral reaction when they close the app because they saw an idea they don't like. But TikTok was like, bring it on. And that was what TikTok, I think a lot of its success came from, was allowing these ideas and this, like the immense viewership that comes from the visceral reaction that people have. Because it turns out they don't close the app when they see something they don't like. They go to the comments and argue with people. And then they interact with more of that content and they stay on the app longer. Because both positive and negative emotion drive like people's retention on these apps. So TikTok sort of caused disruption to that industry by making political content like a gold mine. And so Meta has changed their policies on it and they now push political content. YouTube, I'm not sure what Google's policy ever was, but it did seem like there was like a little like null like a in the content they were showing where it was political, and now it's sort of there's more of it I'm seeing. So I feel like TikTok has, my experience with it is a positive one, because when I started making the content on there, it was penalized on other services, but it now seems like those other services are trying to poach the audience of TikTok, and they realize the only way they can do that is by competing on political grounds. So you have political content now is just super popular.
Yeah. I actually met the designated head of TikTok Australia in 2019 in Shanghai. And she had never been to Australia. And they were curious as to whether it would take off, right? And so they were coming down to Australia to sign up content licensing deals with, you know, the AFL and I think Sydney Fashion Week and a few other things to get people interested. And the impression I get, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time on it at all, but occasionally I check in just to see what's going on. But a mate of mine says that the difference between, say, a Twitter and a TikTok is that Twitter is much more nerdy and word-based, whereas TikTok is like red pills for normies. It's much more free-flowing, and therefore the reach, it's less pretentious maybe than Twitter is, and much more accessible for the general public. Do you think that's right? I mean, does it trend? Your impression is that, and I guess the algorithm would dictate what you see, but is that the impression you get? It's more accessible to a wider range of people, and therefore potentially more influential than any of the other social platforms?
Yeah, I don't know many people who are on X, and I wasn't on X until months after I was posting. Like, people also told me, why don't you go on X? I'm like, I've never used it before.
Yeah, right.
Or not, like, I can never properly scrolled X. I do now, and I see why people do. Like, it is amazing that the world's leaders are on there. Every organization is. And it's new. The news on there is, like, so rapid. Mm. It's amazing. I should have found it earlier. But you're right. Like, TikTok, you have, like, young, like, guys who watch football and they make football edits who are, like, interacting with my content or other people's content that is political. And it's like, I don't think you ever would have been exposed to, beyond like Sky News maybe, you never would have been like exposed to these ideas.
Mm.
And so I have like the commenters who are detractors or like in support of the content. As I said, these football accounts, football, like fishing accounts, and like guys who probably otherwise couldn't care less about politics, except when it is like a bit fun and exciting. And also that it's even presented to them, which is, I think, what you were saying with the app, the audience and the pretentious nature of X, is that the TikTok audience is just mainstream, like regular people, normies, you might say, whereas X is, as I said, I wasn't even on there. So it's sort of like people who are already that way inclined.
Yeah. Yeah. How does a political party, we've got a political, a federal election here in Australia beginning of May, and it's in Australia, at least, while they're dipping their toes in the water, I feel like there's just a massive difference to in the way that the political parties here are engaging with things like TikTok and X, and the way that, well, Donald Trump and the whole, the US political scene has engaged with that and been influential. I mean, how do you think that it would be possible for them to do it? To get involved, because I think that they're worried, right, that controversial stuff trends and gets engagement, but it's also just a risk, because then you might disaffect a lot of the other people that aren't spending their time on social media and miss a lot of the mainstream types who, frankly, you know, there's a lot of the population still that have never been on TikTok and never even spent much time on X or any other platforms as well. How can you do that successfully?
Well, there is a share of the population who don't even know who like the prime minister is. Like, there are people who are totally disconnected from politics and couldn't care less. But US politics itself is 100% more controversial. Like, being here, being exposed to it and being involved in it while being here, it is far more like, there is no, it's less rhetoric. It's more just like very abruptly naming these issues and confronting them head on. And it's awesome to see that. In Australia, it's like, it's very, like, the way they touch on these things, it's just so vague. They just sort of say cost of living, crisis, and you don't really have to say much more. So they say we're addressing it with like $5 tax cuts or whatever, and that's good enough. And so they can't do TikTok or social media in the same way, because people, as I was saying earlier, they're on there to see like the real stuff that might be a bit more controversial and visceral. And the Australian politics is like muted. In that they can't, like, I've watched Dutton's TikToks and I've watched Albo's TikToks, and it's I wouldn't say it's cringe, but it's like they're operating in a way that they would still have a production team behind their videos. They're reading a script. It's very planned out and robotic. And it's crazy. Like the PM could post a TikTok and get like 100 likes. No one cares. Cause it's just it's compared to what else is on the app. It's just so boring. It's unless they're willing to engage in the controversial stuff, they're going to get no engagement. And what they've done instead is I'm guessing their interns or the youth have these AI edits. I'm not sure if you've ever seen them, but they get like, it's very hard to explain, but Labor and Liberal have this back and forth on social media of making film edits and putting the perspective, the opposition in one, like,
I've seen it.
So hard to explain, but like that's the point they have to get to drive engagement, because they're not willing to talk about controversial stuff.
Mm.
Was it Bob Hawke who said all that time ago that the parties have an implicit pact not to speak about immigration? Is that
yes? It was him. Yeah,
and it's like the firmest and was like, because he said the fear of the parties was a race to the bottom in immigration. Because 80% of Australians strongly disagree with the current levels and want to see big cuts.
Mm.
And the parties must still know that if one goes hard on immigration, that's a clear victory and the other will have to follow suit. And it's like they must have implicit pacts with almost every social issue, because that's embodied by how boring the content is on TikTok. Because the generation that is coming up don't have time, like their attention span is so short, they don't have time for 5-minute like rhetorical drool on being tough on crime. Like they actually want to see like a solution posited that might have to be more drastic or whatever. And the point I'm just trying to say is that they haven't had success on short form content because they don't really have any policies to sort of fluff. Maybe the energy debate is like the most intense one they have, and even that, not really.
I mean,
conclusive.
Mass immigration is the issue which is upending political scene across the West, but Australia has been, at least at political level, unresponsive to that in a serious way, right? I mean, and it's not as though Elon Musk literally just came out with a Twitter post where he said, mass immigration is insane. It will lead to the destruction of any country that allows it. A country is not its geography. A country is its people. This is a fundamental concept. I mean, that seems very logical, but it's impossible to imagine a mainstream Australian politician saying the same thing, right?
Yeah. It's crazy. Like, as I was saying with their energy, there is none. And this is like a high energy issue. To talk about immigration in the way that Elon just did is... it's beyond sort of just rhetoric. Like he was saying that it's going to destroy nations because they aren't just in an economic zone, they're a people. If I couldn't even think of anything close to that an Australian politician has done. I think Matt Canavan has reposted some cool edits. That's like the biggest, craziest thing I've seen. He reposted some old Australian edits.
Mm.
That was like, wow, that's like refreshing to see. But that's how like low the bar is set for our politicians. Like I haven't really seen many talk about what Australia is going to look like or be like in 100 years' time. Where are we going as a people and as a nation? And I think that's like a symptomatic or like a hallmark of the fact that our identity itself is so clouded now. Like you talk about the Australian people and it's just, for most people, they have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
And so until we can revive that identity and revive like the vitality of Australian culture, there will be this lull. But I think it can be kickstarted by a politician talking about these issues.
Mm.
And as I said, the implicit pact means that they can, at least for the moment, not talk about it. But the second that Pandora's box is opened and they have to talk about it, it'll be awesome. It'll be a total, the politics, I think, as a landscape will just be put on its head. Like everything will change so quickly. All the infrastructure of the parties will have to shift around and change to meet it. It'll be a lot faster pace. And like that's the only way I can see we get out of this like energy lull is an issue that necessitates a high energy response being put on the forefront. Something like it's going to have to be mass immigration.
I mean, there's been the Liberal Party under Peter Dutton has announced a policy of cutting 25% permanent migration, and just literally this morning, my time, has said they're going to introduce caps on university places in Australia. Were you a university in Australia? What was your experience like with foreign students?
It's crazy. Like, anyone you ask who's at university, they will tell you that group assignments are the worst, not just because, as it always has been, because many people don't even do the work in them. But now it's like every time a group assignment comes out, the international students need an Australian in their group who understands the English language, and they will just like rush to you and like coalesce around you. And so the universities are like, well, there's a million international students in Australia. It's 1 in 27 people. It's like more than Great Britain. It's hard to even put into words what it's like, because I don't know what university was like before that was normal.
Well, when I was at uni, which is a bit older than you, there were international students, and I was actually studying Chinese, so I was a little bit more exposed to them. But I would say it'd be like 5%, and you know, they were an interesting kind of like fringe group for some of them, maybe mainly kept to themselves. But they were. And then I went back recently to my university, and I was just amazed at how much development had happened, but also the character of the university had changed dramatically. And I think some of the, you know, the good old baby boomer generation simply don't understand the change that's occurred, because their experience with university was vastly different. I mean, and the social scene, everything else has just changed beyond recognition.
My contrast would have to be being an American college. Like, people who are at this university are American. The lecturers and professors are American. The faculty that is American. Everything is totally American. Like, it is crazy. Like, when you're an international student, it's crazy. It's like, yo, like, where are you from? And it's wild. And nearly all the international students are from Anglophone nations. Although in like graduate classes and stuff, you do encounter more of like non-Anglo nation international students. I'm not particularly sure why that is, but it's like, and all the undergraduate stuff, the bachelor stuff, is all Anglophone nations, Ireland, the UK, even like Germans and Austrians and stuff are around. So like, it's like everything, it's been a totally different university experience. It's unbelievable. I have no idea, like, this is how it could be. And it's so much more engaging as well, even in class. Like, the discussions are so much more in depth. Like, people, like, it is actually feel like an education. It doesn't feel like Australian universities where you just sort of commute in, go to this class where you can barely understand the lecturer. People in the class you can't converse with because they've can't speak English, and on their iPad they've got an app that's like live translating the lecture.
Yeah, right.
And it's like and you just leave straight away. You go home. You don't want to stick around in that environment. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of sad that like Australians are missing out on that, and it's probably making our universities, I think, as people say, they're turning into like, they've been corporatized. They're there for the money now more than they are for actually providing that education experience. But it's like revealing being in an American university and seeing that contrast. For sure.
Well, there used to be, again, back in, you know, when I was at university, a regular cohort of American students that were at Australian universities. And I think now the numbers have just completely dropped off. And being not only just replaced but changed dramatically with the cohort from, well, predominantly China and India, right? I mean, what's interesting to me is that the numbers of Indian students and the population of India that has arrived in Australia over the last 20 years has increased dramatically. It used to be the case that you'd go to the UK and they would be much more attuned to sort of, tikka masala and all the rest of it, their national dish and that. But Australians were much more comfortable at a yum cha restaurant on a Sunday. But that's changed, right? And I think it's changed. I'm in Queensland. I think it's changed even more dramatically in Melbourne. Can you give people a sense about what you've kind of seen over the last, say, 10 years in Melbourne with regard to Indian influence or Indian in Australia?
Yeah, well, we're saying, like, I think the year was like 2000. There were 30,000 Indians in Australia, just about. 25 years later, we're at 1 million. And it's like 90-something percent of that million were themselves actually born in India. Mm-hmm. And the million or so there are mainly concentrated in Melbourne, Sydney, and areas in the NT, I believe, as well. But in Melbourne, like, it is very difficult to explain how when you go to the new northern or western suburbs, it is everyone's Indian. Like, there's no other way to put it, because that is the current and the largest migrant group, and they're entirely coalesced in those communities. And I'll have to, when I get back, just do a video where it's just me walking around a suburb like that and like the shopping center attached to it. Mm-hmm. Because it is crazy. It sounds like hyperbole, but like, you will literally be the only Australian in a large radius. And yeah, it affects, like, except for maybe like the police, for example. The police will themselves still be Aussie, but that's about it. Like, it is, the scale of it is crazy. Because it's not like they've come like in a trickle, like over many decades. Mm. In 25, okay, for example, I gave 25 years to go from 30,000 to 1 million, but in the last decade, it's more than doubled.
Mm.
10 years, it's more than doubled their population in Australia. It is like the scale of that is crazy, and it's so evident in these suburbs, and obviously particularly then the universities and the city itself. But the northern and western suburbs are so stark because those are long-term communities that are forming where it's strictly India. It's not even like back in the day where Sunshine was like the Lebanese community and a bit of like the Islander Tongan community was mixed with also a bit of the Chinese community. These are like new communities where it's like just Indian. Because that's how quickly a wave has come in, and they've secured this housing and their communities. And so it's funny because you have politicians say, oh, you know, the young families can live out in Wollert, for example. Mm. A young family has to live in that. Mm. Like, dude, it's kind of, we have to relegate our young families to be in that environment. It's sort of disappointing. Like, we can't even have an Australian community of young families. It'll be an Australian family within an Indian community.
Well, I looked up the other day the suburb from where the film The Castle is set, and that was 1997 or 1999, right? I actually looked at like what the cost would be to buy a house there in 1997, how much that's increased, and also the demographic makeup of that suburb. And, you know, back in the film, there was, you know, lovable Farouk who was, you know, wanted to blow things up. And there was a kind of, you know, good interaction between a, you know, bit more of a multicultural side of Australia. But the population demographics are much different now. And they're probably not even as bad in that. I think it's cooler, the suburb, but it's they're not as bad as they are in other suburbs of the world. And so that idea, which I think is a lot of people in their mind have about the outer suburbs being a bit like the big block from The Castle where you can work as a part-time tow truck operator and support a family on three and, you know, and have a, you know, bit of sort of rough, a little bit rough, but hardly a terrible sort of place to live. That doesn't exist in the same as a viable option in the same way as it once did, right?
No, because I mean that's how it was sold to Australians. There were films that were like basically propaganda and TV shows that were propaganda to advertise multicultural big Australia, and the idea was like, yeah, they'd have all these sort of communities, but there'd still be that dominant Aussie one, mm-hmm. and they all sort of fuse into that in their own cool, unique ways. We're all Australian, but that whole concept is totally defeated where if the community is so saturated with a population who is born in a different, like if a community is like we look at these Indian communities and the parents are all born in India and all the children are born to those parents who are born in India and they are the dominant culture in that community. And they will, you will look at the schools in that area. They'll all be Indian with Indian teachers. There is not really even the opportunity or actually more so the pressure to adopt the Australian culture and to live up to that multicultural dream where they assimilate in and they become Aussie, because why bother? Like you look at areas in London, like Birmingham, like some communities might have been there for now two generations. They don't look any more like they've adopted UK style of culture, because there's not that burden. There's not that pressure. Because why would you bother if you are the dominant culture? Like, why would you?
I say to people, it's a completely natural thing to want to cling to the culture of your own country. You can't blame these people unless there is significant pressure to give up that which you once had and loved, and you know, form new attachments. People,
well, I went to the Muslim Votes Matter, and the launch of that. And they talk about assimilation now as being actually quite a thing that to be avoided. Why should they say quite militantly, why should we give up any part of our identity to be the model migrant? That's what she said. Why should we be the caricature of the migrant draped in the Australian flag, give up our language or anything? And so like they're hostile to the idea now, even of assimilation. And it doesn't help that we've given them a lifeline to not have to bother.
Yeah, I think it's this is a fundamental flaw in the thinking of the bipartisan consensus in Australia. And it's this, it's that they've thought to themselves, our nation is, we've got, it's a bundle of liberal axioms, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, all the rest of it. And it doesn't matter in 50 years' time what language they speak, what culture they practice, as long as these sort of abstract principles remain. It's untested whether that is possible to even continue with those and maintain those freedoms in such a, you know, multicultural society, multi-ethnic society. But it's completely different in a mentality to what once existed in Australia, which was, these are our people. We want to, you know, pass on our traditions, rights and culture and our kin to the next generation and continue that as we build our nation. And yeah, you might get some leavening from overseas to a certain extent, and they can intermarry and, you know, fight alongside us in wars and the rest of it. But it's just a very different conception of how a nation state should operate and what actually can help it endure. So, how do you think it will end, Ozpil? I mean, both in Australia and Europe and in the United States, what's your sort of general impression about what things look like in 20 years?
Well, in the States at least, like the enclaves are very obvious. Like there's an area of Baltimore and you go there and it's like, it's almost like they're not physical barriers, but you can cross one street and it's like a Protestant American street, and you cross another and it's like the African American vernacular English street. Like it's crazy. Like the communities will, to the disappointment of the multicultural fans, latent segregation exists, not because of a policy failure or anything, but because communities, in order to perpetuate, draw these natural boundaries, which are not respected, but they're sort of like enforced. Because if you're not a Hindu and you're just an Aussie family, you don't want to live in an area where, and people might try and say this is like abstraction, but it's like not actually that fun to have holy H-O-L-I every year and the associated music and customs and language blasted in your face and you're trying to raise a family. Like it actually isn't conducive to like the problem is like if you can't really, we just have to wait and see basically. And I think in 20 years, the way that this ends is I can't really see it. Like I don't want to give that prediction. You have got some researchers in the UK who say the UK is headed towards a civil war. I don't know if you heard that was a podcast. I forget the researcher's name, but he was very like well tenured, and that was his observation. He's like, yeah, 5 years we're going to have a civil war.
He was an expert at civil wars globally. I mean, he appeared on a Louise Perry podcast amongst other things. And yeah, he was very mild mannered and spoken, but his analysis was dire for the UK. And I mean, the laws of gravity apply in the UK just as much as they do in Australia. So if we do the same thing those guys do, you know, you're going to end up with the same result. One would assume, right? So the US seems a bit, despite the fact that, well, its challenges are different, right? It was Mexican illegal immigration predominantly, and they don't have the student numbers that, as a percentage of the population at least, as we do. And so, you know, things are, well, you're in Florida, right? Things are, it's a very different environment still to what you know.
Well, what America, what I can say America's done better in terms of assimilation and maintaining cultural hegemony is, like, when I went to my first basketball game, I've been to ones years ago in America, but this was like the one I went to here. The game starts and you put your hand on your heart and you look towards this massive American flag and you sing the anthem. Crazy. In Australia, you might get that during the semifinals for the AFL and the grand final, but Americans will do it even for the intramural club games. They will do this is like, and it is incredible, the feeling of having this entire stadium look at this flag, hand on heart, and singing this song. And everywhere you look, there are American flags. I went up to the College Democrats and spoke to them just to see where they're at. They had three flags. They had the American flag, the NATO flag, and like the Pride flag. Mm. And I said to them, it is incredible you guys fly the American flag. Do you guys not see it as like a symbol of like colonial oppression or whatever? And they have like no idea what I'm talking about. And I explained to them that in our politics, it is actually it's a strong political message to have the Australian flag. People know that you must be right-wing inclined or, you know, an evil nationalist. Because our Labor Party, especially their youth wings, will not have the Australian flag when they're tabling at a university. People are afraid to fly. It is like on Australia Day, it's so contentious. And I'm explaining these things to their Democrats. And being the youth wing of the Democrats is a very left-wing form of it. And they were blown away. And so like what I can ascertain is that the funk and the failure of nerve of Australia to assert itself inside of its own border has meant that we have, and I see this a lot online, these migrant communities saying Australia's stolen land. Australia doesn't, you know, why are you complaining about immigration? You guys are immigrants. You're the original immigrants. How'd the Aboriginals feel? The Australian flag is a blood-soaked flag. And so this mythos that we've actually sort of helped to cultivate has led to an excuse not to assimilate, because why would you assimilate to the genocidal, evil Australia? Whereas in America, it's like even the migrant groups themselves, although some definitely detract from this, but many want to be an American and a proud American at that. And so the crudest, like, display of this is just the fact that the flag itself is respected. And it's like America, hoorah, like we are American, flag everywhere. And so that's like the most basic. And then you have the song at the games and stuff. And so that's like a culture, not a culture, but a symbolic of a culture that is healthier because it has allowed itself to defend itself. Whereas in Australia, like it is so strongly attacked, as I was saying in those comments, where it's like, yeah, Australia hasn't even been real. It's all stolen land and all this stuff. And it's the fact that we've entertained that and we let people like Adam Bant not stand in front of the Australian flag. That's only going to end in even more polarization between actual Australians who still associate themselves with that flag and all these new communities and some older who begin to see that flag as a testament to the culture which they like. They see the Australian flag and people who sing this anthem and stand up at the grand final as just the white Australia culture that they don't want to be a part of, because they've been taught, for example, you go to a citizenship ceremony. What do they say at citizenship ceremony? A welcome to country. So even as you get your citizenship to this country, you're like, it's like winked and like hinted at you that like, this is a totally illegitimate country. You're being first of all, welcome to the Aboriginals country. Oh yeah, here's this piece of paper for like Australia. Yeah. Like, I don't really know how to. I should have spent better time consolidating these thoughts. But does that make sense?
I got it, man. Like, I mean, yeah, it's there's anti-Americanism in the United States. I think probably Republicans fly the flag more than Democrats. overall, but it's still nothing. It's still, love of the flag is still saturated.
But even their Communist Party, the American Communist Party, has integrated the American flag into their flag.
Yeah, right.
It's like even their left wing wants to be a part of the American like flag. The Democrats fly it, the Communist Party flies it. In Australia, it's hard even to conjure up like the strength of the right wing to really properly engage with it.
Yeah, and I mean, civic nationalism has its limits, I think. But if you're going to get a multi-ethnic grouping bound to a nation state, then you have to have a really strong sense of promoting those civic symbols like the flag and the anthem and love of country as well in the education system. And we are just sort of, you know, we're doing the worst of all possible worlds, right? We're sort of eroding that sense, civic sense of unity at the same time, you know, ramping up mass immigration to such an extent from people from vastly different places where even the best civic culture in the world would probably be overwhelmed, but we don't even have the best civic sort of.
What we were saying earlier about the communities not having the pressure to integrate because where they presently live, they are the majority. But also that, like, you can imagine that's like the state, on the state level, there's no reason to do it. But on the federal, more like spiritual level, like the mythos around Australia is that it's just stolen land and should be discredited. So it's like a double whammy, you know. It's like you have so many excuses not to assimilate now and actually to push back against Australia and its iconography that where that Civil War researcher in the UK would say like probably might give a worse prognosis for.
Well, yeah, I think there's probably some differences because of our mix. Europe has a different, immigrants have come from different countries to those have traditionally come to Australia, although it's changing. I'm going to wrap up because I've got to head off on it. You've got to head off to your bars in Fort Lauderdale or wherever you are, right? But you've tapped in a little bit to the conservative media networks in the US. I think I saw you having a debate with Charlie Kirk, and I think you've been on a few other podcasts over there. How have you found that, and what have you learned?
Well, I mean, they're a lot more open to have these debates and to create a bit more of a spectacle. And it is, you know, again, like I'm always reflecting on the experience I'm having here to the one in Australia. And like, I don't really know if we've got even remotely the same political infrastructure as they have here. We don't have a Charlie Kirk, Sky News. Who even is their youngest commentator? I'm not even sure. Like, Sky News doesn't really have, like, there's not that same, like, America's like politics is very tightly intertwined with like the entertainment. Like the way that Trump himself was a former like reality TV star.
Yeah.
In Australia, like, I don't even know their background. Our politicians are just politicians, careerists, and the infrastructure around that lacks the entertainment. And I think maybe that's because we have voluntary voting. In America, you need to drive people out to vote. And even with all the spectacle they can create of it, it's still only like 200 something million out of the 300 something million that vote.
Not even that, yeah.
As in, if even that, right? Like, as in to say that in Australia, the entertainment hasn't intertwined with politics in the same way because you can just, there's a crutch of the fact that people are going to have to vote anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, the UK has voluntary voting like the states, but it has nothing like the same sort of infrastructure. Although, I mean, they each have their own.
There's BBC News, certainly.
It is, and they have. I mean, London is so big, and there's sort of cultural infrastructure there that's existed for a long period of time, publications and the like, and a somewhat of an attitude towards intellectual discussion. We're spread out in Australia. I think we can hold our own. I think it's actually a genuine problem to be solved because we have good journos, very successful media proprietors. We know a bit about how to, and often journos you know, foreign correspondents working for major networks around the world. I've been Australian over the years, and we're quite outward looking and well traveled. I think it's actually something to do with the fact that, you know, Americans want to hear Douglas Adams talk about Western civilization, but they want to hear Australians talk about koala bears and, you know, Bluey episodes and this, that, and the other. So, but I think it will change, and whatever, you know, what you're doing, and the market is now open. You can communicate to the world on these platforms in a way that once wasn't possible. So you can build an audience globally, as you know. So who knows what the future will hold? Hey man, I'll wrap it up. What's the future hold for you? When are you back in Australia, and what do you want to do going forward?
Look, this is the one thing people do ask me, and I have not given it any thought. I've like accidentally fallen into this whole TikTok thing. I'm not even sure if I want that to be the defining, like, I think it, but it's like forcing itself on me. It's like the part of like the success has come from that, as in like the success on the platform. I never like intended for that to sort of be like what I become. But with the amount of like messages I get and support in those messages, and people like thanking me for what I'm doing, and like I'm like surprised that people, it actually gets to the degree that people have to thank you for just saying this stuff. I haven't thought it out. Again, I didn't expect it or necessarily think that it would end up defining like the last year of my life. And I'm honestly not even sure. Like, what do you think I should just lock into it?
I think, well, look, the problem, you probably lose all your fame, ironically, if the major parties actually tackled mass immigration in a serious way, right?
Exactly. If the Liberal Party speak about immigration, I'm cool, because I can't just say duopoly anymore. Right.
But it is interesting, the youth engagement. In a way, I think that people are much more responsive to this. Well, I think you mentioned the fact, you know, that in Canada, there's a major sex ratio difference between male and female within the youth. I.e., there's more men than females because of the influx of foreign students. And I think there's stats that came out the other day which shows that that exists in Australia as well, although not quite the same extent, but still growing. So you can kind of understand why young men and young women, because they're both, you know, impacted by that in different ways, might be particularly kind of concerned about a mass immigration if it was framed in an appropriate kind of way, like you're doing in an interesting way. And the major parties tend to be quite, overusing the term, but baby boomer kind of have a baby boomer type of mentality where they both don't recognize the real problem, but also kind of find the whole subject a little bit distasteful in a way, like they don't know how to properly.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's like, I don't know what, it is very odd, you're right. Like I spoke to someone fairly senior in the Victorian Liberals and someone senior in like the Federal Labor. Mm. And they were sort of related to like the planning divisions and like the ministerial representation of that.
Yeah.
And when I brought up like immigration, they were like, not dismissive, but it was like, very odd for them to hear that. And they're kind of like, what are you, like, they don't understand like the arguments I was putting forward. And it's just odd. Like, that means even internally in these parties, they don't really, you're actually quite right. That was a really good, they seem like they see it as such a low, like a lower form of politics, and they're above that, and they sort of step over it, even though like millions of Australians have strong reactions.
Look, the polls show, like, they can't even read polls. The polls show this is a major issue. You know how you said before, Bob Hawke, you know, there was a collusion between the parties on immigration. I think there was to some extent, but I also just think they're in a different zone. They don't
know. Well, they're in Canberra, very far away from people, Australia. They live, like, they're entirely in those circles. Like, John McGowan explains that very nicely, the fact that they are, like, he had some, like, long-form tweet, and it was like how they're just in Canberra, and they do live in a totally different world and mingle amongst themselves. And earlier you mentioned like the Liberals did come out with some cuts to students and cuts to immigration, like 2 years, 25% reduction, you know, very, very weak. But I was looking the other day at the poly market, like for the election, Liberals were like leading by so much for so long, and then in the last like month or two, it just Labor has shot so far ahead them, and Liberals, they're it's over. Like, and so now they're scrambling to produce some half-hearted immigration policy, but it won't be enough.
Yeah, you need to sort of set. Oh, look, I'm hopeful, but you set the scene. It should have been set in advance, and people should have been prepped for this a lot more early. That this was going to be the defining issue of the election, and
it could have been a referendum on immigration.
Yeah,
and I think like you asked earlier as well, like what do I think in the next 20 years? Well, what happened to the Tories in the UK getting just demolished by reform in Australia? The Liberals are set up for the exact same thing. If and when a party comes that makes that their primary focus, and they can drag in. If they can poach a good enough, I don't know if we have a Nigel Farage, but if they can, some whatever equivalent they can manage, the Liberal Party will have zero infrastructure to deal with that rhetoric, like the Tories in the UK. It's incredible how it's like the exact same situation unfolding, albeit 5 or 10 years behind.
Yeah. Look, it's very, unless they address that the major parties, unless they're responsive to community concerns, they won't continue to exist, and other parties will jump up in their place. It's hard to get a new party up. It's hard to get the quality of people and the people who want to like hold branch meetings and do flyers rather than make TikTok videos. So it's a different sort of skill set in some set. But I'm sure that there'll be plenty of stuff for you to comment on in future and keep people interested on this particular issue, because it's not going away in Australia or anywhere in the Western world. If people want to, I'll drop this all in the show notes, but if people want to follow you and aren't following you at the moment, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Well, if you go to auspill.com, auspill.com, I've got all my social media links there on every platform, basically. And you can follow me on there. I'll have to do some more long form stuff soon as well, because I feel like it's getting to the point now with the analysis I can provide on TikTok and stuff is too surface level. When I do stuff like this, it sort of shows, because as I was saying earlier, a lot of my ideas haven't consolidated enough to be presented in more analytical format. So I will, I imagine your audience would definitely not be the TikTok kind.
They should be. They should be.
They should be.
You sort of downplay the content of your videos, but they actually make some points really succinctly and really effectively in a way that long form can't. So I think it's always about like a variety of different things. Have the long form, have the short stuff. It's got to work at multiple levels, because that's the way you get people in and get them properly engaged and informed. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the goal of the right wing in Australia just in the next year will have to be, we've got the arguments now. We know that people like them. We need to build just a longer, we almost need a think tank. We just need to build very rigid like rhetoric around that, and to make it so we don't get a strengthening of the ideology. Because at the moment, it's good and you can present it easily. But for the people who need to be more, there's room for more intellectual engagement.
Yeah. Well, that's what Nat Conestoga in parts is trying to do. But as a think tank. But hey, really appreciate your chat. You go party with the Fort Lauderdale babes and look forward to more TikTok and other content coming forward, mate. Take it easy.
Yeah, we've got the basketball final being played. So I'll be jetting off to watch that.
Who's that between?
It's in San Antonio. It's a college.
College basketball. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But we've been watching it in Midtown. There'll be some big parties for that. So
yeah, cool. I can live in the dream. Aussie influence in the US. Take it easy, man.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Bye. Ciao.
Bye. Bye.